I was going, oh, I want to see this animation. I want to see how these blocks fit together. And finally got to see it on Ancient Aliens. It was
yes,
really
and you've
cool.
actually seen the deluxe version, because let me tell you, the version that I had or have is nowhere near as sophisticated and beautiful as what they came up with, the computer animation team of Ancient Aliens. I mean, they really did a fantastic job. And then there were some other animations where, for example, they finally showed how the Piri Reis map fits on a world map in what particular, you know, position. Because when you just see the Piri Reis map, which was discovered in 1531, and it basically shows, you know, a whole bunch of land masses that were unknown back then, and one of the mysteries of that map is that it shows the landmass of Antarctica without the ice. And, you know, they were actually able to superimpose the Piri Reis map on top of an actual world map, and it fits perfectly. And for
oh, yeah.
a visual, it was absolutely, you know, gorgeous to finally see how, you know, this map really fits with all of the, you know, continents and the oceans and what have you.
Yes, that was one that I because I've looked up and read about the Piri Reis map, you know, for years, and that was the first time I've able to see it laid out where you could actually see all of South America
mm-hmm.
and see where all the rivers and everything line up.
Yes.
It was really good. It was very well done.
Yes, and of course, you know, the legend or the mythologies behind the Piri Reis map. Piri Reis was this general, his admiral from Turkey, and when he was asked, you know, where did you get this map from, he always said that, you know, he compiled this map from other maps that existed previously. So basically, what we have here is a compilation of different maps with which he created this one main Piri Reis map, and it shows basically all of the outlines of the land masses of South, North, and America, and the eastern side of Europe and the eastern side of Africa, and all fits perfectly with, you know, a map of the world today. And the question is, how was this done? And the legend behind the map, of course, is that Piri Reis has gone on record and said, well, these are all based, this map is all based on maps that were left behind by the gods. And of course, as I've said in the previous program, whenever I mention the gods, that's lowercase g, has nothing to do with God, has nothing to do with any spiritual beings or any hocus pocus. You know, our ancestors simply misinterpreted these beings that visited them from outer space as, you know, gods, even though they were simply flesh and blood space travelers.
I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. It was great. And before I forget, I want to say happy early birthday to Eric von Däniken. He will be 74. On April 14th. So
yes,
happy birthday,
will.
Eric.
Yes, and as everybody has seen on the Ancient Aliens program, he still looks great. He's still as energetic as ever, and he is actually working on a new book, and in German. And his latest book that was published last year in the German speaking world will actually be published in English this coming fall, and that'll be very exciting that one of Eric's books will be once again published in English.
Oh, cool. Can you give us the English title for it?
It's all in the wraps still, but the book will deal about the elusive Taos Gold topic and the caves in Ecuador, because about 35 years ago, Eric got into a whole bunch of hot water with his one book entitled The Gold of the Gods, in which he described this metal library that he witnessed with an explorer by the name of Juan Moritz down in Ecuador. And he was labeled a liar. He was labeled a fraudster and all those things. And here we are 35 years later, and it turns out that everything that Eric described in Gold of the Gods turns out to be correct after all. And it's basically a book in which he vindicates himself after, you know, so many years of basically, you know, not revealing anything because of certain agreements that he has made that he honored for many years. But since a lot of these people have now died, he felt it appropriate to come forward and tell the true story.
Oh, awesome. I've wondered about that, oh, man, for years.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that book twice.
Uh-huh.
And always wondered, you know, man, it'd be great if you could come forward and tell where this is it, where this is.
And a year ago, or actually two years ago, that book did appear in the German speaking countries, and you know, right away it has become another bestseller, and I'm really looking forward, you know, to make the book available in English as well. And, you know, obviously the book will be offered, you know, on the legendarytimes.com website, and we'll, you know, write a little review and a synopsis in Legendary Times magazine and so on and so forth. And, you know, we're all very excited that, you know, because the last time was since a book by Eric has come out in English, it's been about 3-4 years now, so it's about time for a new book.
Oh, I'll be looking
in English, of course.
I'll be looking forward to this one with on needles and pins.
Yes.
I also wanted to mention the photographs and the flyovers that he did of Nazca. Nazca has been an enigma and a fascination for me for many, many years. In fact, just a few days before Ancient Aliens aired, I went on Google Earth and finally was able to, you know, kind of locate the spider that's
mm-hmm.
there, and you can barely see it, but it's there.
Yeah, no, I mean Google Earth is a great, great tool, you know, to explore, you know, from the comfort of your own home. And yes, you're right. I mean, the footage and the photographs that were shown about Nazca is truly spectacular because everything was shot in HD. And, you know, usually in the past, whenever we appeared on some programs and we were, you know, asked to talk about Nazca, what the producers only focused on was the figures, you know, such as, like you mentioned, the spider and the monkey and the fish and the whale and, you know, all those different animal shapes.
I know where you're going with this one.
Yeah, exactly. But nobody, you know, mentioned, some mentioned the lines, but the most spectacular thing that we have at Nazca are these gigantic mountaintops that are just missing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's a logistical problem because picture, you know, any mountaintop basically, you know, converges at the top at a, you know, a summit. And there are entire mountain ranges at Nazca that do feature a summit that, you know, converge at the top. But there is 2-3 mountaintops that have been flattened and they look like a table. And nowhere in the region do you find any rubble or any stones or any of that rock that, you know, at one point was there, you know, as a mountaintop. And it's truly incredible because nobody talks about those things. And for the first time ever, or actually at length, they took the leap. And in Ancient Aliens, we actually, you know, discussed that topic at length.
I agree. I'd heard a very, very brief mention, and I forget where it was, but it was again on a deal on Nazca.
It was on Mysterious Journeys on the
I
Travel
think that was
Channel.
It.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they just briefly touched on that.
Very briefly, yes.
They didn't say anything about no rubble being found, just that the mountain top, just what, they only said one mountain. They didn't say that there were more than one.
Yeah, it's just missing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that I really appreciated you going into, because I kept wondering about these, this flattened mountain, and then come to find out there is three.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely, the words are missing. It's basically, it's ridiculous, because it makes no sense. And then, of course, the question is, you know, why would anyone try to quarry off an entire mountaintop? For what? It makes no sense, unless, of course, all of these mysteries that we have from a long time ago are nothing else but messages for a future generation, and that future generation is us. Yet the great majority of our generation chooses to remain blind, and or at least they, you know, look the other way. And
well,
we don't.
And to coin a phrase that you were using in your lecture at Laughlin, they, archaeologists expect us to believe that these mountaintops were flattened using stone tools and chicken bones.
Yes. And by the way, they say the same thing about that the stones at Pumapunku were also worked with, stone tools and chicken bones and obsidian and things like that. And as has been firmly established, the stones that we find at Pumapunku consist of granite and diorite, and the only stone that is harder than diorite and granite is diamond. So it's absolutely it's a physical impossibility that stone tools or copper or any sort of soft metal tools were used to cut these stones, because, you know, you need to have something harder than whatever material you currently have, and the only one that, you know, with which that is the case would be diamonds. And we would all agree that archaeologists disagree that they had, diamond-tipped tools back then.
And then if I remember correctly, too, in your lecture, you mentioned that the surface of the stone blocks and the fact that all the ruins and everything there
are vitrified.
That's what I was going to mention, is vitrified, which
yes.
is basically melting it into a form of glass.
Yes, exactly. In fact, if you look at the pictures, you know, it all looks very rough because of the weathering that these stones have been exposed to for thousands of years. However, you know, when you go there and you touch these stones, they feel like a bathroom mirror. I mean, they're very smooth, and the only way that such a smoothness can be achieved is if, you apply the process of vitrification, which only takes place with, very intense heat. So the question is, how was it done? And it certainly wasn't done with a couple of, normal fire torches or something like this. So it's truly a mystery. I mean, anyone that says that, Pumapunku or Nazca, all the mysteries have been solved, doesn't know what they're talking about. And I'd be the first one to admit to say that, we don't know the final answer. And that is the way that it should be, because the moment you become like the mainstream or the archaeologists that say this is how it was, and this is the final answer, then that's just knowledge is a malleable thing. It's always changing. It's never static, and that is the one thing that I really have a problem with the mainstream science. Because you can look at any science book from 200 years ago, and I guarantee you 50 to 60 to 80% is incorrect. But back then, all of that knowledge was the latest in research. It was the latest in, acquired knowledge. Yet here we are 200 years later, and virtually none of these textbooks make any sense anymore because we now know better, and we truly do. So, you know, regarding to, you know, with the ancient astronaut hypothesis, I wish I had a time machine. Yeah, I would like to go, you know, to the past to see if we're correct after all with our ancient astronaut theories, but I also wish I could go in the future for, you know, 200 years from now and see, you know, if you know, the ancient astronaut theory has finally been accepted by the mainstream.
For those who don't know what Pumapunku is, would you mind telling them?
Oh, no, no, absolutely. Pumapunku is a place in the highlands of the Andes in Bolivia, right where Peru and the countries of Peru and Bolivia meet. It's about 50 miles from Lake Titicaca, which is the highest navigable lake in the world. You can actually visit there today, and you can travel on the lake on these reed boats that are made out of reeds by the Aymara Indians, and it's a very incredible and slash romantic type of journey that you can take across Lake Titicaca. And right next to that lake, like I said, 50 miles away, is a world-famous archaeological site called Tiwanaku. And Tiwanaku is famous for the Temple of the Sun and the Temple of the Moon, or actually the Gate of the Sun and the Gate of the Moon. And it's this very intricate, designed, monolithic type of gate. And, you know, every day there is hundreds and hundreds of tourists that visit there and take a picture of that gate. However, you know, and after they've taken the pictures, they look around, they look clueless, and then they, you know, board the bus again and they, you know, drive back to La Paz or to Sucre or wherever they are, you know, their hotel is. But what nobody talks about is that only 150 yards or so away from Tiwanaku is another site called Pumapunku. And Pumapunku has these gigantic stone platforms and stones that at one point all fit together, and they, you know, it was some sort of a monument or some sort of a complex that right now is in complete and utter ruins. And, you know, these stone blocks that I'm referring to are truly gigantic. I mean, they're upwards of 800 metric to 1,000 metric tons. And they're just, you know, strewn about the plateau up there, you know, in the island of the Andes. And, of course, when you ask archaeologists, you know, how was all of this done? You know, how was it all transported? They say, it was all done very, very easily because they used wooden rollers. Well, what I fail to mention is that we are at almost 14,000 feet altitude. And, you know, that basically means that, you know, after 10, 11,000 feet, that's the altitude, that's above the tree line, which means that anything above 11,000 or 12,000 feet, I forget which one it is, no trees grow anymore because it's too high up in altitude. So there never were any trees that they could have, you know, cut down with which they could have used, you know, the wooden rollers. So none of these explanations make any sense. And then the other explanation basically is that this was built by the Aymara Indians. And the Aymara Indians, who, by the way, they still live there to this day, when you ask them, you know, did you guys build this? They will say, no, it wasn't us. And when you say, well, who built it then, or who lived here? They will tell you that Pumapunku has been like it is today, in ruins, since the beginning of time, or since the Aymara Indians themselves appeared on the scene. So they have no idea what this place looked like when it was, you know, before it was destroyed. And like I mentioned at the outset of the interview, you know, all the stones that are or have been used there, it's exclusively, you know, granite and diorite and andesite, which are very, it's like the highest, it's the hardest stone there is. The only thing that's harder is, like I mentioned before, is diamond. So, you know, we have a true mystery there. I mean, in my opinion, Puma Punku is the one truly inexplicable mystery that we have.
What was your personal favorite segment of Ancient Aliens?
Well, that is a very difficult question since I was a consulting producer. So, you know, I really have to say that I loved the whole program. I mean, and in my opinion, what the program succeeded at is that with each ensuing act, the show just got better and better and better until, you know, the final culmination in the last act. Because sometimes, you know, some of these shows, you know, you have a lull somewhere in the middle, or it's not a really triumphant ending. But, you know, this thing really, it built on top of each other, and it just got better and better. And maybe I'm biased because I worked on the project, but, Eric von Daniken himself has also said that this is by far the best Ancient Astronaut program that's ever been filmed since Chariots of the Gods came out as a movie back in 1972.
I have to agree with that wholeheartedly.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You also did appearance on a couple of episodes of the UFO Hunters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tickled to death to see you bringing out the little gold airplane, the South American gold airplane.
Yes. And that was an episode that aired a few weeks ago called Giant Triangles. And the main premise of that UFO Hunter episode was, UFOs that appear to be these giant triangles. And then they try to tie it in whether or not there are any accounts or stories of giant triangles or triangular UFOs in the past, or actually in the remote past. And the answer to that was yes, absolutely. There are these different accounts that we have from every culture, ancient culture from all around the world, where on some occasions, you know, it was the natives or the culture of, or the inhabitants of a particular culture would describe these flying shields that flew around in the sky. Especially we have a lot of such references in the Middle Ages. But also, we have this little gold plane that was found in ancient Colombia. It was a gift for the deceased that was found in tombs. And, you know, that one is basically one of many, because a couple of dozen were found that are eerily reminiscent to, you know, what today's planes look like. And the great thing about the UFO Hunters episode was that they commissioned a model maker to basically create a similar or a large-scale model of that little pendant. And at the very end, they actually, slingshot the model, and it flew. I mean, it had aerodynamic features. And it landed like a normal plane. It was absolutely spectacular. I mean, really, visually speaking, it was very compelling.
You know, from watching that, I was able to deduce, too, quite clearly, that it was built for high speed, because I noticed that it went into a flared stall, with a flared stall for a landing,
mm-hmm.
very quickly, because it didn't have enough speed to sustain its lift.
Yes.
So to me, that looked like it was a high-speed aircraft. It wasn't some, you know, little.
Oh, sure.
Around.
I mean, the thing looks like a what we have to, what is known today as a delta wing, and it's a fixed wing airplane. You see, I mean, and that's the thing that, you know, there are other pendants that were found that really do look like a frog or like a fish or an insect or what have you. But, you know, anywhere in nature, when you have a flying animal, you know, where we have our arms or our shoulder girdle, where our arms attach to our shoulder girdle, that is where in the kingdom of, in the nature kingdom, that is where the wings attach. You know, they also attach to the shoulder girdle. And in that pendant, those wings are nowhere near the shoulder girdle. So, you know, it's not anything that occurs in nature. So that is the number one giveaway. And the number two giveaway is that nowhere in nature do you find a upright or a horizontal, I mean, an upright and a horizontal stabilizer in the very back. It simply does not exist.
I also thought it was an interesting touch that they kind of compared the act of this thing flaring to the space shuttle.
Yes, that was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yes, and where the space shuttle is a lifting body, you know, it requires the speed to stay aloft.
Yes, exactly, because when the space shuttle comes in, you know, after it's done with the mission, you know, it basically, it's just gliding in. It's not under any propulsion whatsoever. And that is, and it lands the exact same way, like that styrofoam model that they put on a slingshot at the very end of the UFO Hunters program. And, you know, it was really funny to see how the one skeptic on the show, he's not a real skeptic, he's a really nice guy in real life. I think his name is Kevin, if I'm not mistaken, the engineer with the glasses. I can't recall.
He's the new guy.
Yes, exactly. What's his name? Do you know?
I haven't seen it enough to remember his name.
Okay.
Right.
Well, anyway, you know, you could tell in his eyes and by the way he smiled that this is absolutely awesome, yet he did go on the record afterwards of saying, well, you know, I'm still not convinced this could just be some sort of a toy. And, you know, nice try, but whatever. You know, because even if it is a toy, you see, there had to be some sort of a initial inspiration that gave away this type of aerodynamic shape. And the idea behind it is that the mythologies and the legends say that there were these flying things that a long, long time ago flew around in the sky, you know, that the gods used to get from point A to point B.
Also, before I forget, because I did forget earlier, the statue, that's the only thing I can think of to call it, is the statue that looks like a fighter jet with a person in the cockpit, and unfortunately
yes,
the head's broken off.
Mm-hmm. That's the headless spaceman object that has been found at the Istanbul Museum in Turkey. And that's another object that really looks very interesting, because you have this cone-shaped vehicle that has this, you know, astronaut or whatever you want to call him sitting inside this this capsule, and there's tubing coming, you know, over his shoulders, and he sits in there really snugly. And in the back of this thing, you know, you have a whole bunch of exhausts, and it's very interesting. I mean, it's bizarre, you know, how anyone would ever build some or create something like this unless they've seen something or they, you know, followed a type of description.
I would have a difficulty trying to describe it myself. It was amazing. I just sat there with my jaw open looking at the picture of it. I'm like, wow, and this is just now coming out?
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, all those things, they're not, you know, archaeologists, mainstream archaeologists, wish they could, you know, brush all of these pieces of evidence under the carpet, you know. I mean, those are all very, you know, unsettling and challenging questions that we're raising, and which is a good thing, because, like I said, science and knowledge is not a stagnant thing. It's always in motion. It's always changing. And, you know, so all those things that were presented in Ancient Aliens and also, you know, in UFO Hunters, I mean, those are all questions that, you know, merit an answer. And whatever the answer may be.
Oh, and then the second UFO Hunters, which I watch UFO Hunters a lot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a great show. It's fantastic.
I think they're doing a pretty darn good job of checking out not only current cases, but revisiting older cases. But this last one on abductees and whatnot, you had some really impressive artwork or photographs of artwork depicting what very well could be Grays.
Yes, and that was the topic of that particular episode, where, you know, they once again wanted to build a bridge between our present and the remote past, where, you know, obviously, as you know, many of our listeners know, there is this talk going on, and it's been for a long time going on, about the Grays that exist or that perform, you know, the abductions, or that the abductees encounter during the abductions. And the question basically was, you know, is it possible that the Grays existed or something similar to the Grays existed in references in the remote past? And the answer to that is a resounding yes, because there are hundreds of cave paintings, but also figurines and other sorts of records that show very similar, you know, alien-looking type of creatures that look like the, you know, today's, you know, the modern-day Grays. And, you know, I mean, when the skeptic, bless his heart, once again said, well, this looks nothing like, you know, the modern-day Gray, I say, okay, hold on, let me show you another picture. And then he's like, okay, this is more convincing. But that doesn't change the fact that, you know, there is multiple races out there, there's multiple species out there, they all look different, and, you know, still, you know, similar, you know, humanoid-looking, but at the same time, you know, there is countless of records that show all these different-looking, bizarre creatures that mankind, our ancestors, say descended from the sky a long, long time ago and taught mankind in various disciplines.
I'd like to digress back to Puma Punku for a moment.
It's my favorite topic.
One of our attendees in our virtual auditorium, Tall Dwarf, was wondering... he had asked if the age of Puma Punku had been discussed. So is there any idea on how old the ruins are?
Well, here's the problem. I mean, the Ancient Aliens program, the narration says that, you know, it dates to 17,000 years ago, which basically means, you know, there is evidence that this thing existed before the last ice age. I mean, right there, that is that's sensational, absolutely sensational.
Wow.
But do we know 100% where, I mean, when, what, and all this? The true answer to that is no, because unfortunately, you can't date stone, because, you know, many or the great majority of archaeological sites are dated by what's called the C14 or the carbon-14 method, where you can basically determine the age of a site by looking how much radiocarbon isotopes are left over, you know, after a certain period of time, because radiocarbon isotopes exist in all of the organic materials, and after a while they decay. But it takes thousands of years, and it's virtually, it takes forever for these radioisotopes to disappear or to decay. Here's the problem, though, that the only materials can be dated are organic materials, such as wood and charcoal and textiles and bone. However, you know, stone is inorganic and it does not contain any radioactive isotopes. So the one big mistake that mainstream archaeology commits, and by the way, you talk to any mainstream archaeology over a couple of mainstream archaeologist over a couple of beers, and they will agree with you. The main problem or fallacy that they commit is, let's say they stumble upon an ancient site, and they find, you know, an old, you know, a couple of pieces of bones or a skeleton even, or, you know, some sort of a tomb, and they find some, you know, textiles, or they even find an old fireplace, you know, that still has, you know, some charcoal in it and all of this. So they go to the lab and they date those remains that they have found. And hypothetically speaking, let's say the results come back, and those results are fairly accurate. I mean, actually, they're very accurate. That, let's say, the charcoal or the bone or whatever organic material dates to 1,000 years B.C. Then archaeology commits the mistake and says, okay, the whole site dates to 1,000 B.C., or whatever organic material they find, whatever is the oldest material that they can find, and it, in one material, for example, dates to 2,000 B.C., then they will rephrase or redate the thing to date back to 2,000 B.C. But that does not mean that the site itself was built in 2,000 B.C., because some, you know, what if the site was built 5,000 years before and other people merely stumbled upon that site and just used it for their own habitation? And that has happened in many occasions. And Puma Punku is one of them. Sure, there are certain things that have been found there that date, you know, to 2, 3, 4,000 B.C. But those stones are way older than, you know, the latest bone that was found. Does that make sense?
Yes, I was just going to ask before you answered it for me if any organic artifacts had been found around in and around Puma Punku.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and they're very old. They're very old. But that is, you know, also the now there is a way. I mean, there is a way to date stone, and it's called the thermoluminescent method. And basically, what that method comprises of is that whenever a piece of stone gets cut, there is an automatic chemical reaction taking place because, you know, the cut surface all of a sudden becomes exposed to our atmosphere. Because before that, you know, it's hermetically sealed. It's, you know, it's in the rock, basically. So there's no, you know, our atmosphere can't touch the rock on the inside. So whenever a rock gets split apart or it gets cut or what have you, an automatic chemical reaction takes place which sort of alters the surface of the stone. And it's a very elaborate process, very elaborate, which also inherently, unfortunately, means very expensive. So there are only a few examples that I personally know of where this method was used, and one of these examples is at the pyramid in Greece. There is about 100 miles outside of Athens, Greece. There is a 14-yard tall pyramid that, you know, archaeologists have dated with that method, and they never released actual age of that pyramid. Legend has it that when this thing was done in 1976, when this measurement was done, that the archaeologists, the moment they received the date or the results back, their faces went all, you know, turned pale. And without saying a word, they just left the site and never came back. Now,
what was the age?
Probably very, 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 very old. You know, some say, you know, predating the pyramids. But then again, you know, we also, especially us in the alternative history field, we don't agree that the pyramids were built when mainstream archaeology tells us that they were built. The pyramids are way older than what we're told. Much
and
older.
And on that note, we need to go to a break, and we'll be back here in about 8 to 9 minutes with Georgios Doukalos, and we will continue this very interesting discussion when we come back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride.
Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew. My guest tonight is Georgios Doukalos. Before we get started, I want to remind everybody again that next week's show will be a pre-record on Thursday, April 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central. You can listen to the show live on Thursday, or join us in the UPRN room in Pal Talk. The show will be rebroadcast in its normal time slot on Saturday, April 11th. My featured guest will be Grant Cameron, but there will also be several surprise guests during the show. The show will be a preamble to the upcoming Ozark UFO Conference being held in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, April 10th through the 12th. And Giorgio, speaking of conferences, you've got a conference coming up here, presumably.
Yeah, and I'm actually very excited about this one. This is a UFO conference and webcast all at the same time, which will take place on May 2nd, 2009, here in San Diego, California. And the conference is promoted and produced by Jason Martell, very dear colleague of mine and Planet X expert. And for the first time ever, you know, you can actually physically attend the conference at the lecture hall, or you can also follow the whole thing live online. Online, you know, there you can definitely, you know, chat with other users that are also participating by watching the webcast, but also you can ask questions to, you know, the speakers and so on and so forth. And it's basically a six-hour live webcast, or you attend the whole conference in person. And it's a very, very exciting lineup. I mean, we've got George Noory that has been confirmed to attend. And, of course, he also has a meet and greet. And so, you know, if you want to have his autograph and have something signed and all this, you just come to the event. But we also have Dr. Roger Lear, who will be talking about the latest about the alien implants. And we have Jose Escamilla and Eric Polterak, who talks about Zechariah Sitchin's best evidence. And also John Greenwald, who will talk about UFOs and the U.S. government. I'm looking forward to that one.
Oh, yeah.
And then, obviously, you have a lecture by Jason Martell talking about the search for Planet X. And I'll be talking about the latest findings in the ancient astronaut field. So it's all very, very exciting. I mean, it's definitely a first where a UFO conference is live broadcast on the web, and you know, audience members have can have the option to personally attend live, you know, physically at the conference, or anywhere from the world you can watch and listen in to the, you know, conference online. And by the way, the website for to sign up for the conference and to find out more information, it's very easy. It's ufostream.com. And then there's a banner with the conference. You just, click it, and all the information will appear right in front of your eyes.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Who came up with the concept of doing the webcasts?
That was Jason. That was Jason Martell's concept, because he is an internet wizard, and so he's got all the technology and he's set up for all those things. And you know, he's definitely a web pioneer. I can tell you that.
Oh, excuse me. I think it's a great idea, because, you know, there's a lot of people that would love to go to conferences, and, you know, the travel expenses, especially
mm-hmm.
the way the economy is right now, is part of the hard part, and plus the hotels and food and everything, it can get expensive.
Yeah, so this is literally the best of both worlds. And we're only, you know, a few weeks away from the conference. And by the way, if anyone wants to attend physically, it'll take place in Southern California in Carlsbad. This is where the lecture hall has been booked. But if you do want to appear or participate in person, make sure you book your tickets soon, because there are only 100 seats available. Now, if you wish to participate in the conference online, there is no limit. The more, the merrier. And it'll be a first. And I'm really looking forward to that. And like I said before, in order to find out more and to see what each speaker will talk about, or a more detailed description and the schedule, just go to ufostream.com and click on the conference banner at the very top, and you'll find out everything you need to know. And by the way, if you attend in person, lunch is included, huh? So we'll even feed you.
Awesome. Awesome. Can you give us just a little taste of what you're going to be speaking about?
Well, I will basically condense some of the topics that I have talked about in previous lectures, but I have some new visuals that I've recently shot, from Angkor Wat in Cambodia, but also you know, some new images and some new photos about the South American mystery of it is totally escaping me right now. It's in the Bay of Pisco. It's this thing that looks like a fork, El Escondrillo or something like this. This is very embarrassing. Thank you for putting me on the spot, huh? No, but rest assured, it'll be very exciting. And you know, each speaker is given one hour, and you know, everything will be live broadcast. And in fact, I can tell you briefly the schedule. At 9 a.m. it'll be the lecture with John Greenwald, and then at 10:15 it'll be Eric Polterak talking about the U.S. government UFO conspiracy. And then at 11:30, that will be my lecture. And then at 12:45 is Jose Escamilla. At 2 is Dr. Roger Lear. At 3:15 is Jason Martell. And from 4:30 until 6 p.m. that afternoon is the meet and greet with George Noory. And we're all very excited to, you know, to have such a great lineup of speakers. And anyone in the world, for this conference, there is no excuse not to attend, because you don't even have to leave your home for this one.
Just power up the computer, kick back and relax, and enjoy the lectures.
And you can participate.
Oh,
because
yeah,
you can fire some questions toward us, and you can interact with everyone else that is watching the program or the conference from home. And I'm really looking forward to this one, because like I said, this has never been done before, and I really think that this will take the whole, you know, UFO field in a new direction, and it's very exciting.
You know, you are a very well-traveled individual, and I'm going to assume that most of my listeners tonight don't realize that English is not your native language. How many countries have you been to, for crying out loud? You're one well-traveled man.
Yes, actually, it's I think it's 54 countries and counting, but give or take a couple, because I have actually, you know, almost lost count. But yes, it's definitely over 54 countries. And yeah, I mean, look, the thing is that the problem with it, and it's, mind you, it's not a problem. What I was going to say is that the interesting thing is that a lot of people that are in this field, they, you know, just talk about things that they've never actually seen or touched themselves, and they try to, you know, make an opinion of that. And that's all great and wonderful. However, you know, the problem with that is that in many cases, there are little mistakes that, you know, creep into the research if someone has never been at the actual sites that they talk or write about. And the one thing that I pride myself in, but also that Legendary Times magazine prides itself in, is that all the authors that write for Legendary Times, those are basically all eyewitness reports, or, you know, eyewitness research reports from people that have actually visited those sites, photographed them, measured them, and touched them. And this is one thing that we talked about before, that unless you have been to Pumapunku, you wouldn't know that the surfaces of these stones are in fact vitrified, because just by looking at the picture, not in a million years would you guess how smooth and how, you know, perfect those surfaces are. And
I agree with that.
We
you autographed it for me, the DVD of the lecture you gave in Laughlin, and there you showed the photographs of like the grooves and the holes and everything is like perfectly spaced and perfectly symmetrical, and I was amazed. And like you said, the stone looks really rough from the weathering.
Yes. But like we established before, when you touch it, see, this is, and that, you know, that adds even more to the mystery. And this is why, you know, we like to go out there and visit these sites ourselves. And this is also how you find out that something, you know, is, whether or not something is worthy of a discussion in the ancient astronaut field. I mean, one such example is, for example, that the non-rusting iron pillar in New Delhi, India. For many, many years, there is this this pillar in this, you know, square in New Delhi that allegedly is not rusting. And the question was, for many years, or for decades, well, how is this possible? Oh, possibly because aliens, you know, made this alloy, this metal, and made this pillar, and thus it is not rusting. Well, you know, I'm sorry to report, but, you know, that pillar by now is actually rusting. Not profusely or not, you know, big time, but, you know, it shows signs of corrosion. So, in my opinion, that particular piece falls by the wayside, out, gone, outside of the ancient astronaut theory, because, you know, that it's rusting now. So, but I don't see a problem with that by disregarding certain pieces of evidence that so far have, you know, have been a part of the theory. Many times people say, but if you remove pieces of evidence or if you debunk them, doesn't that mean that the whole theory is wrong? And nothing could be any further from the truth, because the more mistakes that you eliminate, the stronger your theory becomes, because there are multiple other pieces of evidence that so far have not been debunked. And, you know, by actually dismissing a couple of pieces of evidence, it only makes our theory stronger.
I agree. excuse me. I'm fighting a little bit of a cold today. So you have to excuse me.
You just have to slam a tequila tonight or two, and that'll kill all the germs. You'll be fine tomorrow.
How do you know I was wishing I had a bottle of Cuervo here with me tonight?
Oh, a whole bottle, huh? Not just a shot. Look at you. Wild
oh,
one.
Hey,
okay.
Five shots and I'm feeling no pain. anyway, I've got a question here from a member of our virtual auditorium. Mm-hmm. Actually, my husband, David, but he's a member of the auditorium as well. He's one of the administrators there that keeps everybody in line. And he asks, it seems as though mainstream science accepts the theory of evolution, but they cling to the missing link theory. If you insert the ancient astronaut aspect into what we know about human evolution, then it all seems to fall into place to me. Why do you think science just will not consider the ancient astronaut theory with regards to human evolution on this planet?
Yeah, that's really a fantastic question. And it basically encapsulates the entire ancient astronaut theory, because your husband is 100% correct. The basic tenet of the ancient astronaut theory is that evolution does exist. There is no question about that, because we have the fossil record. However, just like Darwin himself admits, anyone who has read The Origin of Species will see that in every chapter, he himself says, but there's something missing, there's some mystery going on here that doesn't make any sense, and that is this famous missing link. And the ancient astronaut hypothesis the basic tenet is that the missing link is a direct mutation of our genes by an outside extraterrestrial intervention. I mean, basically our genes were altered so that we basically came into existence overnight, because one thing is crystal clear, that a quantum leap happened between, you know, us being in the caves, and next thing we know, you know, we're building pyramids, essentially. So, now, as for the question, why does mainstream archaeology or mainstream, whatever mainstream, not agree, or they don't yet accept the notion of ancient astronauts, in my opinion, is mainly due to the fact that the entire house of cards would collapse, because currently the system is not built upon the idea that there's anything more intelligent and anything more advanced next to us. We are, according to the mainstream, and not just scientists, but also according to the great majority of mankind, we consider ourselves to be the greatest, the most advanced thing that's ever come along in this universe, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, to be honest with you, that would be if we really were the pinnacle of creation in this whole wide universe, or even in this galaxy alone, in my opinion, that would be a huge insult in the face of creation, because it basically means that creation, didn't manage to do any better than us. And there's always light at the end of the tunnel, but we're not doing this great right now. And like I mentioned before, there is a paradigm shift going on, though, because mainstream science knows that something isn't right with whatever we've been taught in school and at university and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that everything that we've been taught is wrong. There's only certain, pieces that they've omitted or that we've been, taught in the wrong fashion. But, I really think that the time is coming for, a new way of thinking. And who knows if this whole, the full-fledged paradigm shift, what if it all happens in 2012? That is the key to 2012. And none of this baloney, end-of-the-world rubbish and doom and gloom and, here we are, it's the end of the world and, the apocalypse and the judgment day and all this rubbish, fear-mongering rubbish. What if it is something positive, a paradigm shift in our, way of thinking, a new age looking at the world from a new perspective, that, our origins are not here on Earth, but, we're from out there.
Well, the Mayans, in their belief system, the 2012 date isn't a date of destruction. It's supposedly the beginning of a time of change.
Exactly. And I'm actually getting goosebumps that you're saying this, but then again, I am on a alternative history radio program right now, so why should I be surprised at all? But the bottom line is that you're absolutely correct. And the thing is that, of course it is not the end. It will go on. It's the beginning of a new a time period, of a new cycle. And, I think I've mentioned this the last time that I was on your program, but, everybody only talks about 2012 or, December 21st, 2012, but nobody talks about, and that obviously is the end. Or that is when the Mayan calendar comes to an end. But what nobody talks about is that a calendar that ends also had to have had some sort of a beginning date. And nobody talks about that, even though we know 100% when the beginning date was of the, that calendar.
Exactly.
And that was on August 11th, 3114 B.C. Now, we all agree that in 3114 B.C., the Maya did not exist. They did not. I mean, even I say they did not exist. And I'm a renegade archaeologist. Now, here's the thing, that, you know, what happened? What was so compelling or so significant that made the Maya calendar start on the 11th of August, 3114 BC? And the answer to that is, and we can, you know, find out about this by looking at the legends and mythologies of the Maya and all the surrounding cultures that live in that region, that that was the day when, that was one of the days when the gods descended from the sky. I mean, that is sensational, that we have a mythology that says on August 11th, 3114 BC, that is one of the days when we were visited by extraterrestrials, or the gods, lowercase g, which in the ancient astronaut hypothesis, you know, were extraterrestrials. They weren't, you know, supernatural beings or anything like this.
Oh, gosh, that just made me think, well, if that's the date that they first arrived, could this ending of the Mayan calendar, which personally, my theory is it's not an ending, it just starts over again.
Yes.
Could be the December 21st, 2012, be when they return?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes. But here's the thing. Look, somewhere in the Middle Ages, the monks that were responsible of actually, you know, keeping track of time and keeping track of dates, believe it or not, someone, somewhere, sometime, made a mistake. So right today, it is not April 4th, 2009. It is not. It is either April 4th, 2006, or it is already 2012. There's a three-year discrepancy or a three-year mistake that was done somewhere, you know, 1,000 years ago or something like this by some monks in the Middle Ages in Europe. So that is very interesting. It is not 20. It is not 2009 right now. And I don't know what else to say to that one.
Interesting.
Yes.
Gosh, now that makes me wonder if we go by, you know, the date that everybody says, you know, 2012, or would it be this December?
Well, we'll soon find out.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, regarding whether or not, you know, the extraterrestrials will or would return, one thing can be gathered from all the ancient texts. And that is the very clear message of their return. In every culture, in every story and mythology and legend that we have, the gods have promised to return. And this is how, you know, in today's modern, well, mainstream organized religions, in each of these religions, you have that ever-occurring promise of the return. You know, Christians are, well, fundamental Christians are waiting for the return of Jesus. The Jewish community is waiting for the return of their Messiah. And, you know, the Muslim world is waiting for the return of what they call the Mahdi. So the question is, you know, why do we have in modern day religion all these references or this idea of a return of some type of a deity? Now, let me go on record of saying that I do not think, number one, that Jesus was an extraterrestrial. He was not. He was a normal, you know, flesh and blood human being that was able and had the capability of moving people. He was an incredible man that was able to move people and get them to do, you know, good things. Now, why? Because the basic premise of the ancient astronaut theory, one of the basic premises is that all the forms of religion that we have today, mainstream religion, of course, mainstream organized religion, are a direct result of visits of flesh and blood extraterrestrials in the remote past. I mean, that's all there is to it. You know, it all goes back to extraterrestrials visiting Earth thousands of years ago, and our ancestors, because their technological frame of reference was different than what we have today, they misinterpreted this technology or this technological visit as something divine in nature. Angels were considered to be, you know, this is how we have angels today, that, you know, anyone flying around in a rocket pack or something or rather, or being able to fly, was turned into something divine, even though whatever our ancestors saw in the remote past that today are considered angels, you know, these flying beings, you know, floating around or whatever, that was nothing else but a flesh and blood extraterrestrial flying around with some technological device. I mean, that's about as clear and sober as it gets. And I'm sorry to burst anybody's bubble.
Well, I have a tendency to agree in large part with you on that.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to let the audience know that I am a deep believer in God. I have not lost my belief in God at all. I just disagree and do not agree at all with the Western notion of God, or the biblical kind of God, which, by the way, the God described in the Old Testament, in the Bible, that is not God. That, according to the ancient astronaut hypothesis, is a flesh and blood extraterrestrial. And so, you know, the Western notion of God, right when you start talking about God in Western society, that discussion, right from the beginning, is inherently flawed. Because my idea, or many people's idea of God, is totally different than what the accepted idea of God is.
Very eloquently said. That's just a perfect description of the way I feel.
Yes.
There is, though, however, a growing, how do I put this, faction, so to speak, of Christians here in the United States who think that UFOs and extraterrestrials are demons and fallen angels here to corrupt the planet and take everybody to hell.
Yeah, but I really have a hard time with that, because, I mean, that's just science fiction. And somewhere you just, not you, Dee, but just as a human being, you know, we have to draw the line somewhere and really distinguish between fact and what can really happen in a real world and what just has to remain in the realm of fantasy. And you know, the whole talk about demons and Satan and angels and fallen angels, I mean, that to me, with all due respect, the discussion is over, in my opinion, because you can't argue or hold a normal discussion with people that hold such beliefs, because their mind is already made up. And that is unfortunate.
I agree wholeheartedly. My argument was always, well, you know, if they're angelic or they're demonic, that means they're a supernatural being. So what the hell do they need with a nuts and bolts aircraft for?
Nothing.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, see? I love being on this program. You have such a clear mind. It's very refreshing to talk to someone that you know can distinguish between logical argumentation and then total flights of fancy.
Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure.
I have another quick question here from a member of our virtual auditorium. Tall Dwarf asks, if you have an interest in cryptozoology, and what are your thoughts on Sasquatch with a possible tie-in to ancient astronauts?
I'm going to be truthful with you and give a... Was it Tall Dwarf?
Yes.
Tall Dwarf. I got to tell you, Tall Dwarf, that this is the first time ever in all of the almost 20 years that I've been doing this that I've been asked a question about cryptozoology, and do I have an interest in it? No. Do I follow it? Yes. Do I think Sasquatch exists or the Yeti? Absolutely yes. Do I think Sasquatch or the Yeti will ever be discovered? No. does it have a connection with ancient astronauts? I have no idea. I really have no idea. Now, would I be surprised that maybe, Sasquatch or the Yeti is a creature that was brought here? Who knows? So I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't know enough about cryptozoology to make an educated or to give an educated answer. I was just rambling just now.
Hey, no problem. Well, I agree with you. I think, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti, the Yowie, all the other Bigfoot-esque cryptoids, could possibly be remnants of Gigantopithecus.
Yeah. And there is also, obviously the with a discussion like this, the one thing that comes up perennially is the Loch Ness Monster, and do I think that the Loch Ness Monster exists or some type of a prehistoric creature that exists inside Loch Ness? My answer is absolutely, because one thing we have to remember is the case of the coelacanth. The coelacanth is a prehistoric fish that for millions of years has been thought to be extinct, and only, I think it was 100 years ago or 80 years ago, or just in our recent modern times, living coelacanths were found in the world oceans. They were discovered, and it was a sensation. So, now, they're not found in, great, great schools of coelacanths, but they're only found, very rarely and in small numbers. But the fact that the coelacanth, after millions of years, still exists, is another example of we just never know. And here is the crazy thing, that we're always taught or told that, if you have millions and millions of years, you have millions and millions of years in which a creature or a being can evolve. Well, the coelacanth, let me tell you, and anyone can look this up at the library or online, the coelacanth of today is identical to the coelacanth that existed 15, 20 million years ago. So what the heck does that tell you? Absolutely nothing happened in the evolution of that creature. Therefore, the ancient astronaut theory does make sense that things only change if there is a genetic mutation of our anyone's genes. I mean, that right there, that is the argument that you have millions of years in which the coelacanth obviously survived because it was just recently found in modern times, yet the fish is exactly the same like millions of years ago. How come the coelacanth has not changed?
Good question. Getting back to artifacts, anomalous artifacts, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
There is a stone slab that is being heralded as Map of the Creator. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I think so. Is that the thing that was found in the Ukraine?
In the Ural Mountains, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion on that, if you've really delved into it much?
I don't know a lot about it, but of the things that I do know, I would have to say that the jury is still out.
I agree with you on that.
Because, you see, gosh, how should I put this? All the things that I try to present whenever I talk about the ancient astronaut theory, or that my colleagues like David Childress or Eric von Daniken or Zachariah Sitchin, that we try to put forth or in the pages of Legendary Times magazine, when you look at those pieces of evidence, it literally jumps out at you and it sort of makes sense. But the Map of the Creator, at first when I saw it, I didn't know what I was looking at. So, you know, unless it jumps out at me, I usually, you know, like I said, the jury's still out on that one.
Okay, here's another one from David. And I know you kind of mentioned that this about your travel to Angkor Wat, but he would like to know a little bit more about the Stegosaurus carving.
Ah, you've been going to the LegendaryTimes.com
website
today, huh? By the way, every day our news section is updated every day with at least one piece of news. And the piece of news the news bit that we have on there today, anybody can go and look at LegendaryTimes.com and click on Daily News, is a column that was found at Angkor Wat in Cambodia, and it's basically this carving. And this is great, this question, because it does tie in with the whole cryptozoology question from Tall Dwarf, the question before, where on this column, or on this wall, there is a carving of a stegosaurus, and it's uncanny. I mean, it is a carving of a stegosaurus, and the question is, how is this even possible? Because Angkor Wat is fairly is a fairly young structure, or a fairly young complex. And to make a long story short, the stegosaurus is carved like a stegosaurus really looks like, with muscles and skin and so on and so forth. Because and the question is, how did they know what a stegosaurus looked like? Because if you find just a skeleton of a stegosaurus, then I would argue that you might only, you know, carve the skeleton of a stegosaurus, and you don't even know that much what the real deal looks like, because the technology that they had back then isn't as sophisticated that we have today. Today, if we find a skeleton of any type of animal, we have the technology to actually recreate what these dinosaurs looked like a long, long time ago. And my question is, how, you know, did the ancients at Angkor Wat know what the ancient, or what the stegosaurus looked like? And, you know, one theory is that such a stegosaurus or multiple stegosauri actually existed at Angkor Wat. Who knows? Again, it's a question.
Wasn't Angkor Wat also built something like 800 to 1,000 years ago?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the thing is that that is also, in fact, that was part of the program, Ancient Aliens, where the history and the legends behind Angkor Wat, and we recently just reported about this in Legendary Times magazine, that this complex was built with the help of the gods, and that the people who descended from the sky had weapons similar to what we today can see in Star Wars. They had these light swords that were these blue handle, these grips, these blue things that they were carrying on in their hands, and they could cut stone, they could cut trees with these blue rays of light. And what I've just said, I mean, all of this is described in the old texts that can be found in Cambodia. And more and more of these texts are being translated today, and each one of these texts is more fascinating because it describes, in a very rudimentary form, but it describes technology that is absolutely similar to complete science fiction.
I agree. I have another. We've got about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
I have another question from our auditorium. This is from Morniette, and she asks, "I have been looking for information on Rh factor and blood types, and I'm having difficulty finding any that does not deal with pregnancy. Do you know anything, or have you come across anything related to Rh negative blood types in your research?"
Unfortunately, no. No, and I wouldn't even know how to answer the question. But no. Sorry.
Same here. Let's see. We've got 4 minutes left. Would you like to tell us about any speaking engagements you have coming up? The web address for Legendary Times and the UFO conference webcast?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, on May 2nd, I'll be appearing in Carlsbad at the Jason Martell's UFO conference, and the website for that is ufostream.com, and just click on the conference banner and you'll find out, you know, when, where, and what, and who the speakers are. Great lineup: George Noory, Dr. Roger Lear, Jason Martell, and myself. And great thing about the conference is that even if you cannot attend for the first time ever a conference, this conference will be broadcast live with a webcast online. So you can definitely participate no matter where you are in the world. And we hope that you will join us at that conference. And also, if you wish to receive a free issue of Legendary Times magazine, just go to legendarytimes.com and click on free info and fill out the information right there. And next week I'll send you a trial issue of Legendary Times magazine. And,
it's a great magazine.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, there's no ads in there, so it's all articles.
I couldn't put it down.
Great. I'm glad.
David and I were fighting over who got to read it.
Oh, see, next time I have to send you two issues, see? That's
hey,
what it is.
There you go. Also, let's see. Didn't you say you also speak a lot locally in your area?
Yeah, in fact, right after this, I'm heading down to Encinitas, so if there's any listeners who are in Southern California or in the San Diego area, at 7 p.m. in Encinitas at Yoga Swami's, we have a little Chariots of the Gods meetup where, about 40, 50 people, we all just, every other or every 3 months, we get together and we talk about the UFOs and the unexplained. And tonight, we will actually have a screening of the Ancient Aliens program, and that's tonight at 7 p.m. at Yoga Swami's in Encinitas. But that's just informal, because who knows? Maybe somebody will get there by hearing this. Who knows?
Well, gosh, if I was in the area, I'd be there with bells on.
Yes, exactly.
And then I'd take you up on that shot-for-shot thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Next time we meet up, we'll have to do that.
We'll do that for sure.
Oh, my. Hey, unfortunately, we're all out of time. I'm going to have to get you back. Oh, didn't it, though?
Yes.
And I apologize again, everybody, for the computer glitches we had this evening, and I apologize to you again, Giorgio, for that.
That's not a problem at all. It happens.
And thank you for being so understanding. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all those who joined us in the Pelthock Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voices of Deep People, guest hosted tonight by Joe Montaldo. Also need to remind everyone that next week's program will be pre-recorded live on Thursday, April 9th, but will be replayed Saturday, April 11th. My featured guest will be Grant Cameron, along with several surprise guests to coincide with the Ozark Conference that weekend. So join us then, and join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.
Delta Dawn, watch that flower.